KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
University of Washington.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. 100 years ago today, an audience in a steamy hot Paris theater witnessed the birth of a revolutionary artwork. Today is the centennial of Rite of Spring. We'll hear more about it this hour. The American Society of Civil Engineers warns that the U.S. needs to spend more than $3.5 trillion in the next 7 years to bring the nation's crumbling infrastructure up to grade. Last week's I-5 bridge collapse prompted a renewal of calls for upgrades, replacements, and repairs, and it's not just a safety issue. 7th District Congressional Representative Jim McDermott and others warn the U.S. can't expect to continue to compete globally with a crumbling infrastructure. Congressmember McDermott joins us this morning. Hello.
Good morning, Mercy. How are you?
I'm fine. So first question, where are we going to find $3.6 trillion for infrastructure upgrades?
Well, there are a lot of places. What's missing is the political will to do it. we haven't raised the gas tax since 1993. Now, in 1993, cars were getting over 20 miles per gallon or something like that. So every 13 cents or whatever you had on every gallon produced a lot of money. Today, people are getting 40 miles to the gallon. Mm-hmm. And so the gas tax, although it has stayed the same in the rate, is not producing as much revenue as it has. And if we want to have the revenue to do the things we need to do, we're going to have to raise the gas tax. And there's no political will to do any of that. I mean, all we're hearing is no new taxes. So until that basic mantra changes, I think we're in serious trouble in this country, and there are other places we could find the revenue. It's really, as I say, it's a question of political will.
Well, before we talk about the no new taxes, because that's a huge mantra, as you mentioned, coming out of Washington, D.C., what other sources besides hiking the gas tax might at least be put on the table for funding infrastructure upgrades?
Well, I'm one of those people who believes that when you're in the problems that we have today, you should be investing, and that means you should be borrowing money. I'm not one who's afraid of borrowing money. Our bond rating is good internationally, and interest rates are very low, and this is exactly the time when we should be building things that we need to have done, not things that are just superfluous, but things that are essential to what's going on. When we came out of the Second World War, we had all kinds of debt, but we did not, Eisenhower didn't shrink back from building the national highway system. He said, this is the time that we need to invest in the future of this country, and I think that we're in the same situation today.
Many people thought, myself included, that part of the aim of the Recovery and Reconstruction Act was to fund maintenance repair.
Well, if you remember the history of that, it was a very bitter fight because the Republicans basically did not want to give the president the tools to really bring the country quickly back out of the problems that was created. And in doing that, they really stifled our ability to move forward. And in doing it, we wound up simply doing half a job. We could have done a much more robust job in 2007 if we had given the president what he needed. But as you remember, Mr. McConnell said, my number one goal is to prevent the president from being reelected. Now, if he had brought us quickly out of that economic trough, why, people would have said, wow, he's a miracle worker. So in many ways, their effort to hold down the money that was put into the Reconstruction Act was basically to prevent him to have those tools. The money went to the banks. They took care of the banks all right, but they did not take care of building the infrastructure which we needed to create the construction jobs, which, you know, when you've got a $30 or $40 an hour job, you've got some extra money, which then means you buy boats and you buy shotgun shells and you buy new houses and you do all kinds of things. But when you don't have those kind of jobs, when people are working for $10 an hour or $7 an hour, $8 an hour, you are not having the economy bounce back. So we need the high-level construction jobs that are available here.
We're talking with 7th District Congressional Representative, and it's clear if you don't know by now, it's a Democrat, Jim McDermott. I mentioned in introducing you that repairing and upgrading infrastructure is not just a safety issue, but you and others have argued that it hurts us globally if we don't have an infrastructure that's up to date.
Well, we have to have ports, and we have to have shipping capacity to move goods across the country. If we don't do that, we're just simply not able to get our own products to the port. If we're going to ship grain, or we're going to ship apples, or we're going to ship whatever we're going to ship, we have to have the capacity to move that kind of thing in a speedy way. And what we've done when we tie up, you can see what's happened up on I-5. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you have something like that happen, suddenly you realize how dependent we are on this lifeline between us and Canada. If we don't get that thing straightened up pretty quickly, we're going to have serious problems because they're our biggest trading partner. And you have to have an infrastructure that can move the goods between the various places in the country. And it's not being liberal or being conservative or anything else. It's really, what is your view of the future? And I think we have to continue to invest in the future, because that's what we did in the past. When we brought people back from the Second World War, we immediately invested in them. We gave them the GI Bill. We gave them a college education. We said, go out and make this country go. And we did the same thing. Eisenhower started building things, and people followed after him. And investment in the future is really the essence of how you keep competitive in the world. You can't sit back and say, well, we're on top of everything. We don't need to invest anymore because we've got everything. That doesn't work.
So we've been talking about not just, but transportation and infrastructure repair funding. You guys have yet to come to agreement on a budget. We spoke with your state colleague, Kathy McMorris Rogers, yesterday. She indicated she thought that Republicans and Democrats would be able to reach agreement on sections of the budget. From your point of view, is it taxes and tax hikes that's the main sticking point?
Yeah, it's the balanced approach that the president has continued to ask for. When the Republicans, all they want to do is cut things, well, that's simply not an acceptable alternative. They will not compromise on the issue of more revenue. And if you won't compromise at all, it's very hard to move forward. There are a lot of us who would like to move forward, and we're willing to take the tough hit that, you know, nobody wants to raise taxes. That's simply not something anybody wants to do. But there are plenty of places to raise taxes on folks who are doing quite well in this society. The president has made a number of suggestions about upper-income people where there are things that simply may have made sense at some point, but today they don't in this kind of tough time. Meanwhile, we're stopping healthcare research at the University of Washington because of rescission, because of the whole business of holding back the money. And in doing that, we're making our future in danger, because we've made our mark in this country as the global health center of the United States because we have the biggest research facilities in the United States right here. And if you don't continue to invest in that, you turn off the pipeline. You can't compete, and that's true both in human infrastructure and in physical infrastructure.
What's it going to take to break this congressional deadlock?
Boy, there's the question that troubles me every single day. I used to think that economics, or that some view of the future, would do the job. We've watched what happened to Japan. We're simply walking through the same steps that Japan did, and they lost a whole decade of 10 years because they did not invest. They stopped investing in the future of Japan. And we're doing the same thing here, And there's no reason for it except for those people who ideologically believe that somehow you should never be in debt. Now, when they talk about you should run it, you know, well, my family doesn't run in debt. We make choices. Baloney. Every one of us who has a loan on our house is deeply in debt. Most of us own probably the front door and maybe the front windows, or we certainly own the garage door opener, but we're $200,000-$300,000 in debt all over the place. We act like that is good investment. Buying a house, your father told you, my father told me, when you get to be, as soon as you can, you buy a house. So we buy a house. We invest. We go deeply in debt. I remember the first house I bought down in Montlake. I couldn't believe that I would ever be able to pay that house. I paid $16,000 for it.
Yeah.
That was back in the 60s. Well, I mean, but I bought a house as soon as I could because I believed in investing in the future of myself and my family and my children going to college and everything else. And suddenly we've lost that view. I think it's going to come back. I really do. I'm optimistic in the long run because American people are not stupid, and they are ultimately going to turn these guys out who don't want to invest in the future. They simply, we want to invest in our future. We've done it before. It's made us the greatest country on earth.
Congressmember, I unfortunately have to end you right there. I want to thank you for your time. Jim McDermott, representative of the 7th Congressional District in Washington State, including Seattle. This is Weekday.
It's 9:18. Today is the 100th anniversary of the Paris premiere of Igor Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. We contemplate this iconic and highly influential piece of music in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Bedrooms & More, family-owned in Wallingford on Northeast 45th Street for over 30 years, providing a selection of two-sided flippable mattresses designed for lasting comfort. Learn more about flippable mattresses at bedroomsandmore.com.
Madrid, London, Boston all have suffered terrorist attacks and all rely on surveillance cameras to prevent the next one. New York has created an even more advanced anti-terror system.
It's a frightening thing. I'm afraid we have allowed our fear to create an apparatus which is bordering on Big Brother.
Terrorism and technology, next time on The World.
That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, which airs from 3 to 8 p.m.
KUOW and Broadway Center for the Performing Arts presents Tony and Tina's Wedding. When Tony and Tina exchange vows, the audience plays the part of family and friends, joining in the reception, feast, and family drama, May 30th through June 8th at the Rialto Theater in Tacoma. More on the events page at KUOW.org.
53 degrees and mostly cloudy in Seattle. By the way, I-5 southbound is majorly jammed up going through downtown Seattle. A lot of the side streets are jammed as well. You might want to stay away from there for a while if you can. It's 9:20. I'm Bernard Ouellette.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. 100 years ago in a Paris theater, an overheated audience witnessed a performance that's become legend. The music was by a Russian emigre named Igor Stravinsky, the dance by another young Russian, Vaslav Nijinsky, the performance, the premiere of the Rite of Spring, or Sacré du Printemps. By all accounts, the audience was a mix of avant-garde Parisians and wealthy arts patrons, and they erupted as soon as they heard the first few notes of music. Nijinsky's choreography just fanned the flames. It was as far from classical ballet as could be in 1913. The whole thing was new, different, and Rite of Spring has influenced artists ever since then. My colleague Dave Beck, cellist in residence, made it off of a horrible drive, and he joins me to celebrate the centennial of the premiere. I'm glad you made it, and it was probably worth it, Dave.
Yeah, it's definitely
worth it. Who
are
you? Well, Dave, before we go inside the theater, can you briefly set the scenes of 1913 Paris for us? us?
I would be happy to. You know that movie a couple years ago, Midnight in Paris?
Yes,
where the characters travel back and to about this time. And it's no wonder because it was a fascinating place. It kind of reminds me of Seattle at the beginning of the 21st century. Thriving culture, as we'll talk about. Aviation was huge in Paris in 1913. They set a speed record at 126 miles an hour.
That's pretty darn fast, then.
The French went up to 20,000 feet in 1913, so planes were big. Cinema was a huge thing. I think at this time of year, everybody's going to SIFF. All the old live entertainment venues were being converted into movie theaters, so people loved to go to the movies.
And it was also the center for all avant-garde art in Europe, wasn't it?
Yeah. There was so much going on. And this was when the time the Americans were starting to go there, Gertrude Stein and all those folks.
And so all that kind of those entrepreneurs, those dreamers, they were all, a lot of them, gathered in this theater, the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées.
Yeah.
I understand it was an unseasonably hot evening.
The show started at 8:45, and it had been humid and up to 85 degrees that day. So it was a little toasty in there.
And apparently, the audience was primed to react right after they heard the first few notes of the bassoon. And here they are. Sounds pretty tame now, doesn't it? And very familiar to us.
Absolutely.
Well, that recording was made by the Seattle Symphony, and we're hearing right now the principal bassoonist of the symphony, Seth Krimsky. And so we thought, since he's played it, we'd invite him in. And I asked him, which is a little flummoxed him, I asked him to describe Rite of Spring to somebody who'd never heard it.
I would say that rock and roll came to classical music world before there was rock and roll. It was the first time that a large-scale orchestral work relied almost entirely on rhythm.
The first time I heard Rite of Spring, I believe, was in Disney's Fantasia. When was the first time that you heard the piece?
It would have to be Fantasia, but I was so young at that time that I don't know that I recognized it later when I really heard it for the first time. And that was maybe 7 or 8 months after I started playing bassoon, and somebody said, oh, there's a big bassoon solo at the beginning of this piece, so I listened to it.
A big bassoon solo, sort of the most famous bassoon solo.
Possibly, yeah.
It's such a famous introduction to a piece of music. It's unmistakable.
That is correct. Stravinsky did want it to test the limits of the instrument, and in fact, some number of years after he wrote it, he was upset that it was so easy for most bassoonists to play. He wanted it to be very difficult. He wanted it because it's the strain of the first green shoot coming out of the ground and pushing the dirt out of the way and what hard work that is. And he kind of wanted the sound to break up. To really interpret it correctly, we should all play it badly. But nobody's got the nerve to purposely make the note fall apart.
I'm sure that you've read about the Paris premiere. I've heard everything described as from a riot ensued to...
That's what I've heard.
That's what you've heard, yeah, as well. There's somebody who wrote, I believe it was a music critic, that the man behind him was beating him on the head. Was it the dance? Because there was this choreography that was bizarre on stage. Was it that the music was so different? Was it the combination of the two?
I think it was everything, but apparently the booze began with the bassoon solo. Within a second or two after the bassoon started playing, the booze started. And I don't know what the action at that moment was on stage. I think there was one dancer who came out. I know, but both the music and the choreography were under fire. And yeah, I've heard that Nijinsky was pounding the conductor and beating time for the dancers and screaming out numbers. And
partly they couldn't hear the music, but also because you mentioned rhythm, but it's not like it's a kind of... slapping my knee here. It doesn't go like that.
No, there's no... there are sections where it's consistently the same beat for a while, but the famous Danse Sacrale at the end is kind of a just hodgepodge of compound meter. There's bars in 13 and bars in 3 and 2 and 7 and 5 and 9 and just one after the next. And apparently it was Stravinsky imitating an old Lithuanian gardener who would make fricative sounds with his hand in his armpit and all sorts of stuff. And he'd sit on the stoop and do this when he wasn't working on the garden. And Stravinsky tried to recreate that. And it's not It's not solid one beat after the other. It's very complex.
This was the third ballet score Stravinsky was asked to compose by Diaghilev, Diaghilev for the Ballet Russe. The other two, you know, Firebird and is you know, modern 20th century music, but it's different from Rite of Spring.
It's more related to what came before it. And they both have their folk song elements, as does Rite of Spring, but somehow the ones in Rite of Spring are a little more primitive. And to highlight that, he made the music itself more primitive. And it really is almost all about rhythm and what happens when one rhythm bumps into another rhythm.
Is it overall a hard 35-ish minutes to perform?
You know, at this point, I'd have to say it's not really. And I think listening to music of that type has become so ingrained, and kids are listening to stuff like that right off the bat. So it's just not that different to them. It's not that difficult.
Stravinsky himself wasn't very old when he wrote it.
He might have just turned 30. I can't remember. But
quite young.
Yeah.
And I also read that from that first performance on May 29th, 1913 in Paris, that he revised the concert version several times, that he was sort of buffing it up.
There's been a lot of... By nature, he did that with almost all of his pieces. That was not anything new for him. I don't think anything fundamental was changed about it.
Listening to Rite of Spring, sitting in my seat where everybody was reverential, nobody was hitting anybody or throwing shoes or anything that was purported to happen, I had to try to readjust my mind and think back 100 years to what it must have sounded like to hear, forget about seeing the dancers, how this music must have presented itself. And I started thinking about contemporary composers that we listen to these days, you know, sort of the downtown New York scene. That is kind of what this was, wasn't it?
Way, way beyond that.
Really?
Even. Well, yeah. It's funny because Stravinsky did not purposely set out to break any rules. It's just like the rules didn't even apply. There were no rules. Nobody was used to encountering something that had no rules. Debussy, the same thing. It's not that they were being iconoclastic and breaking rules. They just didn't consider rules. They heard what they heard in their head, and that's what they wrote. Huh. And that was not something that had been done really before then. You know, you don't do that. You can break a rule on purpose because you're testing your metal, right? But you can't just forget about the rules. And they did. And yeah, audiences kind of freaked out about that.
And now, you know, I'm not sure that every composer who breaks rules is celebrated. I read at some point Stravinsky was carried off on people's shoulders after some performance. So at some point, opinion changed to such a point where he was applauded for what he'd done. But really what we're getting at here is that notion of how contemporary, how beyond, how cutting edge. The word was cutting edge. What he was doing was
absolutely
was wild.
It's still very fresh and energetic, and it has lost nothing. I mean, it's a great piece, but it is 100 years old, you know. I mean, audiences, I think, need to get over a little bit of the new music thing when it's 100 years old, so...
Somebody that I was reading, I think it was a New York Times article, was talking about somebody in the audience in London, which was, so it had its Paris run, and then it went to London and with the Nijinsky dance, and then that was the end of the Nijinsky dancing. But that somebody said, well, this music, this piece is to the 20th century what Beethoven's Ninth was to the 19th, which I'm sure you've heard as well.
Yeah, absolutely. No question.
They're pieces of music. They're wonderful pieces of music, but they become symbols in a way of something else. What is that thing?
It's the obelisk in 2001. I mean, musically, it's just the next step in the progression of the evolution of the music. The world was ready for an evolution, and Stravinsky provided it. As did Beethoven. I mean, the opening chord of the last movement of Beethoven's Ninth, I'm sure, sent people screaming out of the hall at the time it happened. That was not, you didn't do that. Yeah, there are those moments.
So when you look at composers around 30 years old now writing for an orchestra or a chamber repertoire, who is the equivalent of a Stravinsky or a Beethoven?
At 30, I don't know. That's putting me on the spot. That the one who was 30 not that long ago is Thomas Otis. Definitely one of those guys. And just that huge opera that he just had at the Met, The Tempest. There are so many good composers all the time. We don't really...
Do they have a fair shot? Is there enough access to music? I mean, Stravinsky, there was, you know, some crazy Russian who wanted to commission him, and he wanted to shake things up. Are there enough people in established art circles now who want to shake things up to give young composers the place?
I don't know, but I think we're now entering the time of culture where it's not a necessity for that, that there's so much access on an individual basis for people to see or hear anything, and that the people that can figure out how to get it to them will be very successful. But I don't know if it needs traditional foundations and organizations to get it out there anymore. There's now the opportunity to get things noticed if you're savvy about how you do it. And not that I am or will be, but somebody who uses YouTube correctly certainly could get enough attention to.
Are we, the media, not me personally, but the royal we, I suppose, paying too much attention to the centennial of Rite of Spring?
Not that I can think of. No, I don't think so.
I mean, should it be celebrated?
Yeah, definitely it should be celebrated. And I don't know. I haven't actually been bombarded by it like I was. Certain things about Mozart can get a little bit overwhelming. In terms of what we hear on a day-to-day basis in music, and even people that know nothing about classical music probably see movies. And any movie with a large orchestral score is heavily influenced by The Rite of Spring. Everything that's been written since The Rite of Spring has been influenced by it one way or another. You're either trying to avoid sounding like The Rite of Spring, you're trying to sound like The Rite of Spring, or it's just so implanted in your memory that it shows up in what you do when you're writing. There's just no escaping it. It's possibly the most influential piece of music ever. So how can you really over-celebrate that?
That was Seattle Symphony principal bassoonist Seth Krimsky. So, of course, we need to hear a little bit more from The Rite of Spring.
Seattle Symphony, and they're recording from about 1992 of The Rite of Spring. And Marcy, I get the sense from this 100th anniversary celebration that the focus really tends to be more on Stravinsky and the music for The Rite of Spring, but the piece was originally an elaborate dance and theater collaboration after all. Did we lose sight of the dancers and the choreographers alone?
Oh, I think we have. That original choreography was abandoned pretty much after 1913. I think I want to take us back. The impresario Sergei Diaghilev, who ran the Ballet Russe, wanted to present something that would make a stir. He wanted to sell tickets. He'd already commissioned two previous ballet scores from Igor Stravinsky. And this time, Diaghilev asked his young dancing star, Nijinsky, a lot of folks have heard of Nijinsky, to create the choreography. Nijinsky had done a couple of small things, never anything big. And what he made was unlike anything that classical ballet audiences were used to. The dancers, we mentioned it was 85 degrees and they were sweaty. The dancers were wearing wool garments, and if you see pictures, they look a little bit like Native American women at a powwow. They have these long braids and bandana-like things wrapped around their foreheads. And you've just been listening to this sort of rhythms colliding music. So that's going on. The dancers usually count. They couldn't count. The audience was yelling so loud that, in fact, they couldn't hear. And Nijinsky was standing in the wings trying to count out for the dancers so that they would know what to do. By all reports, this was just like nuts.
Chaos.
So I decided to ask dance historian Doug Fullington, who's the education programs manager for Pacific Northwest Ballet, to tell us a little bit more about Nijinsky and about this dance.
Nijinsky didn't have a lot of experience. He had two ballets before that for very small casts. and then this full cast piece. And I think even getting across his ideas to the dancers was really hard, probably because of his own limitations in communicating, but also the music was just really out there for them.
Was he commissioned by Diaghilev? What was his relationship to Ballet Russe?
Well, he was a dancer for Ballet Russe and a favorite of Diaghilev's. And I think Diaghilev was trying to create this greater multifaceted artist out of Nijinsky.
Was the Ballet Russe, I guess, more normally performing what we think of as classical ballet or classical Russian ballet?
On the whole, I think they were. And they did Giselle, and they did excerpts from Raymonda. So they did a lot of classical things. We hear about the more forward-looking pieces, but they did do a pretty staple repertory of classical.
So here they are in 1913, May 29th, 1913. I've read, you've read, a lot of people interested in the performance have read various things about the audience, the theater. But essentially, there are these dancers who are presented with some kind of, like, for them, weird choreography, right?
Very weird. Turned in, you know, jumps from 2 feet to 2 feet. Really cumbersome costumes.
Big, heavy things.
Yes, yeah, so not costumes that would help you create the kind of line you want to show in classical work.
So they have this weird music, this weird choreography, and from what I've read, an audience, I'm not sure, like half of them were excited about something weird and the other half were freaking out. Or maybe everybody was freaking out.
It sounds like it, but I think they were really enjoying freaking out, and that it became so much about the audience as well that it must have been really hard for the dancers. They say they couldn't hear, and who knows how well it was really played because the orchestra was so skeptical as well.
Normally, if PMB dancers are dancing, how are they keeping track of where they're supposed to be? When are they counting in their heads?
With Stravinsky, usually counts are set, and they're all over the map, from as few as 3 up to a 17. But there is a road map so that they can follow. Now, you're depending on the accuracy of the orchestra, but it is sort of mapped out. Whereas a lot of other music, you can learn the melody and go with that.
So this was 100 years ago. Nobody was used to mapping it out.
Not like that.
Now, I've read that this particular choreography was performed in only a couple of productions. It died until being revived, 60, 70 years later.
Yes, they had the Paris performances, and then they had the London performances where the reaction wasn't so severe. And that was it. Massine then did a version of it for Diaghilev, which was didn't have the reception that Nijinsky's did. And then the piece took on its own life in the concert hall.
My colleague, Dave Beck, says that Stravinsky was sort of lifted up on people's shoulders and celebrated for this great work of music. That's not what happened with Nijinsky.
No, it certainly isn't what happened. And it sounds as though Stravinsky really separated himself from that whole initial experience and made the piece more about the music rather than the story it was supposed to tell.
And yet, I don't know how many Rite of Spring ballets and modern dances have been set, but there are dozens, I would guess. Right?
Yes, dozens.
It's difficult music, and yet somehow it's inspired many choreographers despite the difficulty of sort of moving your body to something that isn't like a heartbeat.
To me, it's a couple of things. One, it's a great challenge, and they know about this rocky start, so I think that continually is a challenge to a choreographer. And I think that they're also spurred on by so many productions and so many that have been really moving, like Pina Bausch's or the sort of reconstruction that was done in the 80s.
And that was the Joffrey Ballet, right?
Yes.
Well, they worked from stills and descriptions. Is that how they put it back together?
Yes, it was Millicent Hodson and Kenneth Archer, and she worked with stills and descriptions. She worked with Marie Rombert, who was Nijinsky's assistant, and there was a score that they found that had a lot written into it about the choreography, at least, who started when, who stopped when. And they took as many pieces as they could and put them together.
Now, you did that with Giselle a couple years back. You were working from actual notation. I mean, it was officially recorded. I mean, that was something that was discovered and you could work from. But it still seems, even if you've got every step written down, which Francia Russell has when she stages Balanchine, there's still... You can never recreate exactly.
You can't recreate it. Francia has a different situation that she was there. So in addition to the sort of physical matter she has her memories that she can transmit. With something like Giselle, that link ultimately is broken, but we do have the written records in varying levels of detail.
Has Pacific Northwest Ballet performed A Rite of Spring?
We have twice. We've done Glenn Tetley's version, which is a more of a full company version, and then we've done Melissa Fenley's solo State of Darkness, which Peter Bohl danced and then staged for several of our dancers.
How many Rite of Springs have you seen, do you think?
You know, I really haven't seen too many. I've seen the couple we've done. I've seen the revival. I've seen the clips of Pina Bausch and some others, but maybe it's less than 10. I'd like to see more because I'm always interested in what's being done to it.
You know, some music doesn't inspire dance, and I wonder if this piece inspires dance because it started with a ballet, or is there something inherent to Stravinsky's composition?
That's a really good question. I don't know that I have a great answer. I know it helps that it started out as a dance. It at least puts the idea out there that dance is possible to this, even though it's so spiky and asymmetrical. But I think, too, it has a lot of visceral power to it and a lot of rhythmic power, asymmetrical or not, that I think can inspire movement.
That's Doug Fullington, Education Programs Manager for Pacific Northwest Ballet. Stravinsky had written music for dance before Rite of Spring, but complicated rhythms in this piece particularly hard for the dancers. We've got links at our website, kuow.org, to a recreation, the 1987 recreation of the original Nijinsky choreography, and to clips from Pina Bausch's version of a dance for Rite of Spring. And, you know, because we're hearing about spiky arrhythmic music, Dave, we've got to hear a little bit more from Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. So I told you yesterday, listening to this, Dave, that it reminded me a little bit of Carousel, Rodgers and Hammerstein's Carousel, when Billy is disconsolate because he finds out Julie Jordan is pregnant, and those kind of heavy chords. It just sounds fresh. And I wonder, you know, from your musician point of view, how this 100-year-old work is viewed.
Well, people revere it and fear it. If you're a musician who is encountering the Rite of Spring, I first played it in 1980 with the Seattle Youth Symphony, and I can still remember just being on the edge of my seat, you know, hopefully making sure that I'm not going to play in the rests, because it's so rhythmically unpredictable that you can just fall into one of these rests. But, you know, new degrees of dissonance and interesting combinations of instruments, and as Seth Krinsky was saying, you know, it shows up in John Williams' film scores and all sorts, you know, whether it's Richard Rodgers or whoever, people are always borrowing ideas from the Rite of Spring. So difficult to play. It's an interesting story about Pierre Monteux, who
was a conductor
at the premiere in 1913. And so he's rehearsing, and they had an unprecedented number of not only dance rehearsals, but orchestral rehearsals. And the musicians kept stopping and asking him if these notes were right. And Monteux had just a great ear, and he could tell if something was right or wrong. And he just finally got fed up and said, "Stop asking me if it's right or wrong. I will tell you if you're making a mistake." And so that's how challenging it
was. He didn't like the music, though, did he?
No, he was still trying to wrap his head around it, even in 50 years later, when he came back at age 88 to conduct the 50th anniversary.
So 100 years later, you had occasion, you've been, I know, sitting in on classes at the University of Washington, but the university's been celebrating it, and you had occasion to talk to a contemporary musician.
Right. John Kimura Parker from Vancouver. His wife is Eloisa Friedman. They run the Orcas Island Chamber Music Festival, and Jackie, as they call him, has his own transcription of Rite of Spring, and he came in and played some of it and told me how he first encountered the piece.
Oh, I remember the first time I heard The Rite of Spring. I was a teenager. I had just started student studies at the University of British Columbia. Of course, I grew up nearby in Vancouver. And I was really starting to get into rock music. And I was listening to a lot of Genesis and a lot of Rush, my Canadian compatriots. and I had gotten a little bit of an introduction to the music of Frank Zappa. And what really excited me about listening to that kind of music was the rhythmic variety, particularly that, you know, those were all musicians that didn't do the standard four beats in a bar rock and roll, but they were much more rhythmically experimenting and harmonically experimenting and really orchestrating their music. And so when I heard The Rite of Spring and was confronted with this as a piece of music from the classical canon, I was a bit shocked because my exposure to classical music had been very, very traditional 18th, 19th century music. So this really sort of opened my ears to the possibilities. And I just loved The Rite of Spring. And I thought, if there's any way to be able to play even some of those notes, how much fun that would be.
And so after that, after you discovered that this piece was out there, mostly orchestral recordings at first, or how did you?
Yeah, I've of course listened to it in orchestral recordings a lot. And eventually, I think it might have been the very first. Yeah, it was the first full orchestra score that I bought for my own personal library. It was The Rite of Spring, and decades ago. And then I discovered that Stravinsky had created a piano duet version, and I was really excited about that, and I got together with a friend and started reading the piano duet version and was immediately disappointed that there were details missing and bassoon lines and, you know, all sorts of cool details weren't there, and I couldn't figure out why would Stravinsky leave those out, surely not on purpose. And it turned out that he was just very expeditiously making a duet arrangement to facilitate ballet rehearsal. I mean, it was really just a serviceable arrangement for that purpose. And I did play it a few times, and I always threw in as many extra details as I could. But I started getting this hankering that I would want to play it myself.
Yeah. And when did that take shape, or when would you say, I'm going to do it now? I'm going to sit down and, you know, make this transcription that I can perform?
It actually started about 7 or 8 years ago that I thought, you know, maybe this is possible. And I found a few different attempts to make a piano transcription over the years, and I took a look at them and realized that they didn't quite work for me for one reason or another. One of the arrangements was quite sparse, just too many things were left out to make it fairly easy to play. Another was so detailed as to be unplayable in sections. And, and you know, what happens when you're writing a transcription of something as complex as The Rite of Spring is you really have to come face-to-face with the fact that if something's written at that level of complexity for full orchestra, that with only 10 fingers, there's just a limit to how many of those things you can play. And there are sections of The Rite of Spring that are fairly simple in texture, and they do fit perfectly under the hands. And then there are other sections that are just so complicated that you're just throwing in as whatever you can and trying to keep enough lines going that your ear really can follow them all. But what I discovered right away is that it's quite obvious in some places that Stravinsky composed at the piano. And, I mean, I'll give you one example early on in the piece in the Dances of the Young Girls, these very famous chords. Those fit beautifully under the right and left hand at the piano. I mean, you can imagine Stravinsky sitting at what apparently was an upright piano that he composed much of The Rite of Spring. You can imagine him sitting there with his hands on the piano, working out chords and finding one that he liked, and it happened to fit perfectly under the fingers. So there are parts of it that make perfect sense at the piano. Mm-hmm. And then there are others that are sort of insane because you're all over the keyboard.
Yeah. While you're at the piano there, help us understand those choices that you had to make in terms of, you know, I love a bassoon line, but how do I include that? How do you go about just deciding how you're going to approach it?
One of the things I discovered is if you're going to do a transcription like this, it's one thing to have voices in three or four different parts of the piano going at once, and you're trying to give them all enough attention. But it does happen very often that there are voices going on at once that are exactly in the same register, that your hand might be doing an ascending figure representing one instrument and a descending figure representing another all at once. There are a lot of different combinations like that. And, well, for example, I mentioned the bassoon missing, and I'll play a couple of chords, and then you'll hear the bassoon line, and it's in exactly the same note range as the chords. And those notes are, your left hand is playing, of those repeated chords, only two notes in one section in order to get that bassoon line, bum, 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 to come through, and then maybe playing three of the notes of the next chord and only one note of the next chord. And so there's a lot of that kind of complicated thing going on. But let me show you something else. In the spring round dances, there's a chord. It's a very simple chord that sounds like this. It's just four notes. And that chord is orchestrated in many different ways by Stravinsky in The Rite of Spring. He orchestrates that chord with horns, and it's meant to just have a plaintive effect. He orchestrates it with violas divided, divisi, we call it, and starts adding in wind instruments, at which point it's supposed to have a melodic effect. And then later on, he gives a slightly different combination of instruments, and it's again a melodic effect, but it has a slightly darker quality. So I'm playing this four-note chord in, first of all, what I would say is without giving any equality, any emphasis to any of the notes. And I'll play that chord later where I'm very clearly emphasizing the upper note because it's melodic. And later on I play that chord and I emphasize the lower note so that I can be melodic in a different octave. And if you put that together, you get this effect that for me is my way of trying to honor the interesting variety of the orchestration. So that way, the same chord can take on many, many different personalities, mm-hmm. and that's what makes it really fun to do this. Mm-hmm. There are also sections of the piece where I'm really just flailing all over the piano, and I'll just give you one example of how crazy it can get. And that just, you know, is fun to play, you know? I mean, it actually feels great to play that at the piano. There's a ton of different details going on in the orchestration, but it takes on what I just think is a pianistic personality.
Yeah. Having sat in a couple of orchestras and played this piece, I mean, it's some of the most intense music making I've ever done as an orchestral musician, just in terms of the fierce concentration it takes, and I wonder how that is for a pianist.
Well, it does require the intense concentration, of course, and I think I want very much for the music to take over the listener and for them to experience the tension in the music. At the same time, there's one huge advantage of playing it at the piano. I mean, for all the challenges of trying to get all these different ideas into two hands, the one big advantage is that, unlike an orchestra player, I don't have to worry about ensemble.
That's right.
I mean, conductors and orchestras are, I mean, you take a passage like this. Where there's doesn't seem to be any logic about how many of those chords you play in a row before you have a rest. And I know if you play in an orchestra, the sheer terror that you might accidentally play during one of the rests and be the only person in the whole orchestra that played in the rest, you know, it's terrifying. And from my perspective, since I'm playing the whole thing, I don't have to worry about any other person. If I want to take a section faster than I've rehearsed it, or slower, take a different kind of timing with it, I mean, I'm free to do that in performance and to be inspired in that way. And that's terrific.
Finally, even beyond music, what has the Rite of Spring come to represent to you as an artistic and cultural achievement? Just an amazing, you know, product of Stravinsky's mind and human imagination.
The Rite of Spring has become timeless. It's a work that, even though we are very actively celebrating its centenary, it seems in some respects hard to believe that it was 100 years ago, because you hear the music, and I think at the piano, some of the, you know, modernist elements of the music come through even more clearly and in more relief. You hear it and you think, this could have been written a lot more recently and fit into one of the many different directions that classical music is currently going. It doesn't sound dated. And I hear lots of music from the mid-20th century that, for one reason or another, sounds dated, or it sounds like it's of a very specific time period. You know, it's like listening to 70s rock and roll or something, you know. I mean, you can identify where, you know, when it comes from. And I don't feel so much that way with the Rite of Spring. I feel like it was it just appeared. It seems like it appeared out of nowhere. It created this incredible stir. If that was a legitimate stir, you know, there's all these stories about maybe that the riot was partly staged. Who knows? But it created this incredible ripple effect in the world of 20th century music, and it still sounds fresh to me.
That's John Kimura Parker, the pianist and concert artist. He recently transcribed and recorded his own piano version of The Rite of Spring.
It's a lot to celebrate, and the more that we listen to people talking about it, Dave, the more I realize what an amazing and revolutionary work it was. And, you know, next hour you can think about the news, Robert Horton, Vaughn Palmer, all that coming up ahead on Weekday, but we can't leave the Rite of Spring yet. We're going to hear one last piece of music. Dave, will you set it up for us?
Yeah, this is the Sacrificial Dance. The Chosen One is the name of this final section. An ecstatic dance to the death. And it starts out with the repetition of these 11 violent chords that just explode from the orchestra and then go into this frenzy of those shifting meters and repetitions that we've been talking about that drives to the very end. And then the young woman just drops.
So. Okay. We're breaking barriers here on 94.9 KUOW, Stravinsky's Rite of Spring.
Igor Stravinsky's Rite of Spring had its Paris premiere 100 years ago today. It's 9:59. I'm Bernard Ouellet. Afghan insurgents have attacked the International Red Cross in Jalalabad. The full report in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
The shadow of sexual assault in the world of competitive sports.
I could name for you right now four coaches that have produced Olympians and in some cases in the...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.